He'd go through them with a tank and destroy what takes several years actually to perfect, and it has to be right all the time, because once you smash a levee, the water that's supposed to be exactly 4 inches tall, it runs off and it's 1 inch standing water, and that'll mess up your entire rice field.
The tanks just move right through the fields and through the hamlets too?
Right. It's more important that you bring a tank into a hamlet. So, you know, you have a tank there in case one person fires at you, you can fire back with a tank. It's more important to get that military equipment in there than it is to worry about the rights, or, you know, they don't really think that any of these hamlet people have any rights. Who are they, you know?
What determines the need to bring in heavy armor and stuff like that? Is that because it's there and the enlisted men are supposed to use it, so they use it, or is it the command that likes to see action?
It's both, really, but as long as you have some tanks around, the generals and the colonels and that will never let them go unused, because if they go unused, then the guys aren't, you know, getting in their day's duty and all of that, so they... All the brass will always employ everything they have. It's, you know, it's just a great big merry-go-round for the most part.
How about expending ammunition? If you go on one of these things and you don't fire X number of rounds, or if you've got armor with you and you don't fire X number of machine gun rounds or armor rounds, does that mean that you... will that reflect poorly on the company commander? Are these company size things? Operations?
The least that you ever approach a hamlet with is a company.
That's
120 or more guys to surround, you know, 20 or 30 people.
Right.
And if you're going into anything of any size, you take a battalion.
And the if you move through it and just walk through the, in other words, let's assume that you were to just walk through the hamlet and you didn't find anything, and you go on to the next place, would that be considered not having done the job right?
No, not really.
I mean, do you have to shoot some things up to?
You have to get rid of your ammo in some way, but you don't have to. Go out of your way to do it. Like, you can, they have you you know, test your ammunition and things like that, but if there's the slightest what any officer would or sergeant would consider a provocation or a chance to fire, they always jump right on that. But you don't have to fire on every hamlet, or it's not that bad.
I remember now the story I was trying to think of earlier, which is that on a search and destroy mission, and I think this is quoted in the My Lai book, search and destroy mission, an old man was standing in front of a hut and was gesturing, and the soldiers were going through the village hut by hut, and the old guy was gesturing frantically, but spoke no English. And this was taken to mean that he was trying to protect something inside. This was taken to be a hostile action. And a hand grenade was tossed into the hut. And later, when the people went inside, when the soldiers went inside to see what, you know, what remained, they found that what was really going on in there, that there was a woman and a child who had been inside, and the elderly man, probably a grandfather or something, was trying to communicate with the soldiers that there were people inside there who were sick and couldn't come out, and he was apparently trying to tell them to come in. I don't know. This is the story. But there must be a fearful lack of communication if nobody speaks either, if the two languages are not spoken in most instances by anybody except very haltingly. It must be incredibly difficult to find out from either side what's going on.
Well, it is. that's quite true. And a lot of times, like what you're saying, the more someone will gesture in a manner like this, the more the command tends to think that he's hiding something or sheltering enemies or things like that. They tend to go right off the deep end pretty quick. And unfortunately, it's not just a command. You have a few trigger-happy guys, too, who will go off the deep end themselves. But anytime, like, people read through the My Lai incident, and they feel that this was just an isolated thing. If any time you go into a village, you go in with a lot of fear, and fear leads to panic, and although I don't know of anything to even approach My Lai in proportions, there's been almost every other time there's a death occur either from shooting or throwing a hand grenade somewhere, which just plain out shouldn't have happened under any circumstances. But when it does, rather than take disciplinary action, why the brass just chalk this up as another combat victory, you know, a couple more scalps for their mm-hmm. collection. Once a person is dead, why they're labeled as a Viet Cong, you know. I mean, their politics are assumed to be something after they're dead. So,
what happens? Is there any attempt made to when? I want to put that question off, which I didn't even ask. I was going to ask what happens after you leave a village, but I don't want to do that yet. I want to ask you about the. We see pictures of soldiers burning down these thatched hut structures. What's that all about? How frequent is that, or is that just something that news photographers like to take pictures of?
No, that's fairly frequent. I would say I remember this happened with us one time. We were in a village, and the brass was really panic stricken that there was this was a place where ammunition and that was hidden. They made us go through each hut individually with a mine detector looking for ammunition and mm-hmm. things of this nature, and we didn't find any, and yet they had us burn every place in the whole village. And I mean, the people, they just figured the people, well, they threw up the hutch in a day and they can throw up another one in a day, but that's not true. I mean, they can get up a hutch faster than we can build a house or something, but you can't just burn down a village and go out blasely and think that people are going to have it built tomorrow, you know.
What happened to the possessions of the people in that village? Burned down with their houses?
Yeah. I mean, they might have been able to take out one or two things, but for the most part, they're just destroyed.
Why? What did the when you say the brass? You mean the brass on the scene, like the captain who was the commander, or higher up?
No, this thing was the captain on the scene issued the orders this time.
And what did he say?
And doubtlessly,
burn it down.
Yeah, just burn it down. Doubtlessly, he was backed up by higher ups from him, but they like. Anybody higher than a captain, they almost never actually touch down in the field. They may hover above it in a helicopter
mm-hmm.
at most. Usually they're way back in the rear in some tactical operations center giving orders. That's what they're usually at physically, besides where they're at mentally.
What happens after the after the search and destroy mission is over for a particular village? Just leave, that's it, goodbye?
Yeah, I mean, they leave and...
What happens to the people who are hanging around, you know, the civilians? People who live in that village?
They go back to what's left. Usually, in most cases, their village is pretty much as it was. But see, I've been inside these tactical operations centers. They're known as TOCs. And the one that I was in was a brigade-sized TOC. And like
that's the headquarters in the rear?
Yeah, that's the rear headquarters where the colonel makes command decisions. And he has a map up of the area of operations. And like there are these little pins which tell the date and so forth in which a hamlet was last passed through. And what they do when they have nothing better on their mind is they go and check this board to see, and they say, well, you know, this place hasn't been observed in a couple of months, so we'll send a company in there just to stir up some whatever we can stir up. And these TOCs are pretty grisly places anyways. The one that I can remember, the brass had put up some pictures of people with their guts torn out and all torn up and lying dead on the ground. And of course, these were labeled as Viet Cong massacres, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, the people were just as dead no matter who killed them. It could have been us in lots of instances. It was our things which killed them, but this particular colonel had a fascination for seeing dead bodies.
That's a nice.
That's not really extreme for the morose way they view things.
We have the rustling around that you hear is Bill Reynolds, who has just come in. And so you're going to hear some more rustling around. We've just been joined by Bill Reynolds, who... Soldier, you're 45 minutes late.
Yeah, I know. You're hard to find.
Well, wish that we were, actually. Why don't you, Bill, why don't you tell how long you were in Vietnam and what you did there, and then we'll pick up the conversation.
Well, I was in Vietnam for 15 months, and I was in aviation as a crew chief for the same division that Pete was in, and then I was grounded and put in the infantry for 5 months.
You were grounded. I remember we spoke before last week when I was putting this program together, trying to find people to come up here. You were grounded because you refused to fire on a village, is that right?
Right.
Tell that story.
Well, we're sent TDY, which is temporary duty, to protect a small base camp. And in the one morning, they started, you know, getting a heavy rocket barrage. So they sent my unit up to destroy the tubes once they were spotted. And the tubes
Let me just interrupt you a minute. I have no idea what a rocket actually is. Is it like a bazooka? Is that?
No. How would you describe a rocket?
Because it's always in the paper that, 17 rockets landed or something. What actually
A rocket is something like a mortar, only it's fired differently. It doesn't require as detailed a setup.
And what's the range of a rocket?
I don't really know. The range is less than of a mortar. Usually rockets are fired from pretty close in.
And why are they called
the
rockets?
The accurate range is low.
I don't know. I don't think they're accurate over 100 yards, probably only like less than 50.
Okay, so you were... it's a mobile thing, isn't it? I mean, you pick it up and carry the weapon and the shells around with you and set it up someplace and fire when they take off, right? Do we use them? I mean, is it an American?
Yeah, mostly from helicopters, though.
I see.
It's a different kind of rocket.
You've got to get closer.
That's
good.
Is that good enough?
Yeah, that's fine.
Well, when the unit spotted the tubes, they started hitting them. We started receiving back heavy fire, which we discovered there was more out there than we thought there was. And it was a village situated about, I'd say about half a mile from where the fighting started. And we lost three ships, so they called in for assistance from another aviation. And they came in, they started hitting the village. and we weren't receiving any fire from the village. The NVA were supposedly out a half a mile in some heavy bush. And they call our ship over to the village. And when our ship flew over there, I says, oh, I'm not receiving any fire from there, so I'm not going to fire in there. And I threw my machine gun out the door.
At that point, you were the senior NCO on the ship, right?
Right. I was in charge of the ship.
And what happened then?
Well,
what happened at precisely that point? You threw your machine gun out the door. What did the warrant officer who was
Well, he thought I got hit automatically. He thought I was hit because there was no fire coming out my side of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And he radioed back and asked me where I was hit, and I said I wasn't. There's nothing to shoot down out there but unarmed civilians, so I'm not going to shoot. And he said just to move to the back of the ship and stay there, and then when they flew back to get refueled and more ammunition, they turned me over to the MPs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was placed under arrest.
What was the reaction of the other guys in the... How many men in the crew outside of... helicopters piloted by two or by one?
By two. Two okay. Warrant officers, one door gunner, and one crew chief.
So then it's a... What about the other door gunner? The other guy who was doing what you were doing, which is door gunner on the other side.
He was so busy, he didn't even pay any attention to it until mm-hmm. he saw me sitting in the back of the ship. He says, what's wrong with you? And I says, I don't shoot innocent people.
What did he say?
He just gave me a dirty look.
Uh-huh. And then what happened? You were taken back to...
I was taken back to where we were temporary duty was at, and then I was flown to Camp Evans and placed under arrest there. Read the charges and all this.
And finally, how did the case come out?
Well, I was found guilty and got 3 months hard labor at Long Binh Jail in South Vietnam.
Guilty of what?
Well, the charge began as cowardice in the face of the enemy.
Cowardice in the face of the enemy.
Right.
Why not, I guess it wasn't disobedience because you would then say it wasn't a lawful order. That would be your defense.
Well, they tried that. It was one of the charges, too, disobeying an order, a direct order.
Yeah.
But they dropped that charge on it, and they dropped the charge down to refuse to fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I got 90 days of hard labor.
Do you, who defended you?
It was a JAG lawyer.
Would you say that his defense was as good as it could be, given the circumstances?
No.
No.
If I would have been found innocent, he probably would have got extended over there.
Something I wanted to talk about. I don't know what you're kicking, but don't kick it.
Okay.
Because it's doing funny things now. He's doing it.
No, I'm doing it.
Pete, you're not doing it. Bill's kicking something that's doing funny things to the meters. You can kick anything out. You can kick him. You can kick me. But you can't kick the equipment. One of the things about this war, I think, that bothers me whenever I talk to anyone who's been there, is the question of, since leaving aside the political issue of our intervention, given the fact that we are conducting a military operation of enormous magnitude against an enemy, a described enemy, who is not really visible except from time to time, I mean, sort of appears and then disappears. Do you, I guess I'm asking you for an opinion as guys who were actually there and who were shot at from time to time, is it possible to conduct that operation in a more humane way? In other words, do we have any choice between, from the point of view of a guy on the scene, is there any choice between either saying this war is so dirty that continuing it is just something that cannot happen, and saying that there is a way to fight the kind of war that's going on here without killing thousands and hundreds of thousands of civilians?
Well, I think that, you know, it could be done a lot more humane.
The whole question of humane war is kind of silly.
I was just going to say that is ridiculous, but of course there could be a lot less just wanton slaughter. I mean, if people did like Bill did, and when they're told to fire on villages from which there's nothing but people down there with no defense, no ammunition, no return fire, if people just refused to do that, of course it'd be a lot different war. and everybody who has been killed by wanton acts of slaughter like this, there's no excuse for it. But for people to think that the idea of that the GI should improve himself and that is really ridiculous. It's not the GI's war. He doesn't want to be there in the first place, and it's the war of the Pentagon, of big business interests in the country, and the poor guy who's dragging himself through the muck has really very little to say about the general tone of the war. He's brutalized as much as he can, and when he reacts in a inhuman fashion, it's completely predictable. So people should think in terms of changing the war, not of trying to bring an individual troop up to some Superman level.
Well, that's the question. Can the war be changed, or is the only solution on the most realistic level, is the only solution to stop it? I mean, it is a fact, is it not, that WBAI New York, that's a fact. It is a fact that servicemen are, because of the fact that they're there, are being shot at by Viet Cong and North Vietnamese who are moving through civilian areas. That's correct, isn't it?
Yeah, well, one of the big reasons that guys do tend to overreact is friends of theirs, buddies, and that get killed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's enough to make any human being react in that sort of a fashion. And in order to really get the war over, you have to take decisive political action. And as far as I'm concerned, that means bringing them all home right now, which is what peace groups have been saying for 5-6 years, as long as the war has been going on.
Then the paradox that we would see here, the paradox of of a war a war that's being fought basically because it's being fought. I mean, that holds true. The analysis that's prevalent in this country, at least that my analysis of a situation in which this war has to go on by virtue of the fact that we are there, is sort of a self-reinforcing, a circle that's closed just by virtue of the fact that our troops are there, is actual a military reality from the standpoint of a guy who's walking around there getting shot at, too.
Yeah,
right?
the fact that it is a vicious circle is just what you're saying, a military reality.
Yeah. What about looting? Do you see any looting?
Yes.
Quite a bit. who was doing it?
That's especially done by, like, soldiers of the South Vietnamese Army, you know, the Arvin troops. Like, when they go through a village, they take, you know, all their food, rice, chickens, anything that's around, they'll take with them when we go through a village.
Why do they do that? I mean, do they take that stuff back to camp and eat it for dinner that
right,
night?
Yeah. They take it from the people who really need it, you know, because they get fed. If they don't have the food, the United States Army usually gives them some. They'll take anything that's not nailed down that they can grab in a hurry.
What do they do with non-edible kinds of things? I mean, do they take household goods and I guess I don't know what possessions villagers would have, you know, bicycles if they have them, or
oh yeah, they'll ride bicycles,
or Hondas if they have
yeah,
them.
They'll ride them, if, you know, if we're in the kind of land you can ride them. I've seen them steal Hondas and bicycles and anything.
Mm-hmm.
Beat, you know, to them it's beat walking. Mm-hmm. If we're in terrain that they can use them in. I've seen a lot of GIs do it too.
American soldiers taking
yeah
things. What does the command do?
Usually nothing in my unit.
Just ignores it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did you? What kind of contact did you two guys have with the South Vietnamese military? I mean, did you the first Air Cavalry is an elite unit, and I think Bill, you told me that they didn't have a great deal of contact with South Vietnamese, either military or civilian. Is that right?
Well, military, I've worked with them for a month. Me and seven other guys were sent with a whole unit of them, a whole company of them. I worked, you know, pretty close with them for a whole month.
Mm-hmm.
Camped with them and ate their food and everything else. They were scared of us, you know, when I was with them for that month. Because some of the guys, most of the guys with us were really crack soldiers, really gung-ho.
Mm-hmm.
And they were scared to death of them because they seemed to send them in first or try to, you know, and we're not sure what we're getting into.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll refuse to go. I've seen them turn and fire. I've been fired on by them quite a few times.
You've been fired? You mean you were fired on by the guys you were ostensibly advising?
Yeah, we got into one ambush, and they ran back, and all of a sudden we started receiving fire from the back of us, and it was them.
Wow. I guess that doesn't make for a close feeling of friendly camaraderie between our allies and ourselves, does it?
Yeah, I can remember one time in my tour, we were sent on an engineer mission to build some bunkers. There were three little landing zones right around the main camp at An Ke, and they were called LZ Tom, LZ Dick, and LZ Harry. They were all just in a line. The idea of Vietnamization is nothing new. Like little LZs like this have been occupied by Arvins for at least 5 years that I know of, and usually there are guys assigned to go out in small groups, like Bill was in a group of seven. And I've seen groups as small as three of American so-called advisors to Arvins on Arvin camps. And for the most part, the guys that I've seen, the Americans, tend to like to get out of this situation as quickly as possible. They feel good about it if they're relieved and they can go back to a American-type unit and situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of the South Vietnamese are drafted, and I imagine that most of them feel about the war even. Well, how do they? I won't imagine because I wasn't there. What do you know about how the run-of-the-mill South Vietnamese fighting man feels?
Most guys that I talked to that could speak English really hated it.
WBAI New York.
Now that's the biggest part. A lot of them support the NLF. And they, you know, forced to fight with the Arvin troops, with the Arvin army.
Mm-hmm.
That's where most of them come that'll turn and fire on you. When they run in, they'll run into contacts. Because they, like when we make camp for the night, they don't sleep in the same area. They do sleep in another area. And they'll go off, you know, off to, if we're pretty close to the enemy, they'll go off and talk to them. You know, and they'll either pay them or give them rice or something like that to do it. They will, most of them, I say about 60% of the Arvin army supports the NLF. They don't want to fight.
One of the myths, maybe it's not a myth, maybe it's true, is that the South Vietnamese people, one of the things you see in the papers, I'll be honest and not get involved in it, is that most of the South Vietnamese really don't care anymore. They just want it to stop. Is that true of the South Vietnamese soldiers that you met? They don't care how it comes out as long as it stops?
That was, I would say, the majority opinion. Like, one time I remember talking with this Arvin who could speak pretty good English himself, and we were asking him how long he was drafted for, and he said, well, originally he was drafted for 5 years, but he'd been extended to 20. And he was sure for having the war come out. And I think I can confirm what Bill says about support within the Arvin Army for the NLF. I'm not sure it's as high as 60%, but I'm sure at least every third Arvin is apt to turn around and take his Arvin gun out in the hills and you know, be there with the NLF when the time comes.
Did you have any conversations with South Vietnamese soldiers along the question of how they felt about being a part of a military operation which was involved in the kinds of actions you were describing when you were talking about search and destroy missions. In other words, they're fighting with
Yeah, I met certain kinds of these individuals. Some of them, some of the gung-ho Arvins are incredibly bloodthirsty.
What?
The ones who are gung-ho are just really incredible.